vehicles going up there, supplying them with not only food and oxygen and nitrogen and things they bring up to to survive, but actually most of the weight is all scientific equipment and also equipment for the space station, or robotics. They have flying robots flying through the space station now. Equipment that gets attached to the outside, a replacement of batteries, thousands and thousands of pounds of batteries that have been brought up over the last couple of years. All of this makes up not only the parts of the space station, but you need food and clothes, and, everything that they wear, they throw away. So it all has to be replaced. And there are six people up there. You mentioned that sometimes they go down to three. They will be going down to three next year, early next year. They'll be dropping down to a crew of three, probably for about a year, and then they'll go back up to six or more. The maximum, then probably come back up to seven once you get Starliner running, by Boeing, bringing a crew of four up at a time instead of three. And the same with Dragon, they'll be bringing up a crew of four instead of three, like Progress does. So they'll be able to have seven people permanently on board the space station within probably a couple of years. This WS2S. Usually I make an announcement for the next launch. There is launch to watch. It's always fascinating as far as I'm concerned to watch these Falcon 9s take off, either from California or from Florida. This one takes off from the Cape, and it will launch from Launch Complex 40. Again, SpaceX has two launch complexes in Florida. And this one is from LC-40, and it's going to be a geosynchronous flight. It's called the Pacific Commercial Communication Satellite. Pacific, like Pacific, except it's spelled with a K. It's going to go to geosynchronous orbit, and it's a rather large satellite. So because of that, what SpaceX normally likes to do is put enough fuel on board the Falcon 9 to save the booster, bring it back to the Cape and land in landing zone 1. They have a landing zone that they built. Actually, they took a launch complex 13 that wasn't being used, and they made a landing zone out of it. They bought a bunch of concrete, and they could actually land 2 at one time if they wanted to. So Pacifica will be launched because it's going to be going too far, too fast. They won't have enough fuel to bring the booster back to the Cape. They'll land the booster on the autonomous barge 400 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean, and land vertically, stays that way, and they bring it all the way back to the Cape, and it will be reused again. They're getting good at that. There's been at least over 40 launches that have been brought back safely, and that booster has been reused many. Second stage now, they let that burn up in the atmosphere. After the second stage brings the payload to orbit, whether it's a satellite like this or with the Dragon cargo vehicle like last week, the second stage just turns around and fires its thrusters and burns itself up in the atmosphere. This way they don't contaminate the space with more space junk. This is WS2. You're going to have it coming up soon. You're also going to have another launch with with another crew, and that's going to get complicated because at one point you're going to have 9 people on board for about a few days. And those 3 will come back, and then another 3 will come back shortly after that. You're going to wind up leaving only 3 on board for a long period of time. That's one reason is because NASA does not want to pay another $85 million per seat to the Russians to put our people on station. You know, they'll be happy with one person, one American on board. But that will mean there'll be an extra seat with the Russians, and the Russians are not getting any tankers for tourists to go up. They had one recently, but they don't have anybody else in line, so that means they'll probably start doing flights of just 2 for the time being. That's unfortunate because, you know, with 6 people on board, you have enough people to maintain the station. There's a lot of work to maintain the station, a lot of hours going to doing that. Not only spacewalks, but just maintaining the inside of it. And then, of course, a lot of the time is used up for science. They have hundreds of experiments going on at one time. And if you cut back on 3 people, that's going to hurt the science that comes out of the ISS. So hopefully that will all change by next year. Next year, anyway, one flight I'm looking forward to is the Mars Rover 2020. They don't have a name for it yet, but that will be going up July 17th. Mars 2020 rover. It's about as big as Curiosity, a little bit bigger. Curiosity weighs just under 2,000. This weighs around 2,400 pounds. It's a little heavier, it's a little bit bigger. Curiosity is about 10 foot long by about 10 feet wide. Roughly those kind of numbers. With long arms that come out from the rover that reach down and able to grab samples or take close-up pictures, or in the case of Curiosity, drill into a rock and they pulverize the rock, and then it lands in a scoop, and the scoop puts it inside the body of the rover where it's analyzed, and you know they have chemical labs inside the rover. 2020 will have the same thing, but one of the differences is not, you know, we'll have a drill on board this one, but we'll also have a core boring drill, so you'll be able to take small core samples around 3/4 of an inch in diameter. That's how big these bits are, so you'll wind up with like these 6 or 7 inch long pieces that will be stored in containers and actually left behind for someday a future flight that will go up, which will be a sample return mission. What that flight will do will go along and find these pieces that have been left behind by Curiosity and taken back to the labs. Like I said earlier, that scientists would really love to get these samples into a lab. They can do a lot more than a science lab on board the rover themselves. So someday, they need money to do that. And right now, money is kind of hard to get, you know, come by. For instance, you have the military end is even having problems. They have military communications and missiles that have to go up on a regular basis on all these rockets, and the funding is no longer there. And the guy in charge of that is actually a ham, Mike Griffin, NR3A. Still got a call letter. And NR3A, Mike Griffin, used to be NASA administrator, and years ago. Now he's involved with, the military end of it. There was even talk of him becoming, in charge of the Space Force, But he's made some statements that pretty much say that a lot of projects are no longer funded. And so it holds true with the military, and same with NASA. Let me drop it and see if there's any comments or questions before I go on. Okay, I guess not. Some more on the Mars rover that will be going up. They beefed it up a little bit. There's a big cross beam that you see crossing the top of it, right in the back, right where the nuclear powered system is. You got to remember that these are all these two rovers are Curiosity and Mars 2020 rover are nuclear powered. They have, I think, around 109 watts are coming out of the RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators that are on the back of these things. And, no solar panels. So, these things power the rovers day and night. So, near the back, they have this crossbar. So, that's going to make the whole setup stronger. The wheels are thicker. The skin of the wheels are thicker. There's no air pressure or nitrogen pressure like we talked about last week in wheels. These are solid metal wheels on these rovers. They beefed up the wheels. They made them a little wider, actually a little bit bigger in diameter as well. The reason they did that is they noticed on Curiosity, since that's been riding around all these years, since August of 2012, here we are in 2019, so it's been up there all these years. The wheels were starting to be damaged. They noticed that about 2 years ago. Holes were starting to appear in the vehicle. Even so, it weighs, roughly 2,000 pounds on Mars. It's a lot less. You have the gravitational field is 0.38, so roughly one-third of the weight. But it's still a lot of weight on these wheels, and the rough terrain is starting to put some holes into the some of the six wheels. So they decided to beef that up a little bit. Sometimes you can see a close-up on it. Sometimes they'll show a close-up on the wheels when they take pictures. And, you can see, especially, the corner wheels will have special holes that are already put into it. And, the holes are used to identify with a camera as it drives along. It can look at the ground, and it creates an indentation on the ground. And first, the holes are laid out in Morse code. You have JPL, you have that on the wheels itself that appears on the wheels. And they're going to do the same thing on a new rover that's going up next summer. I always thought that's pretty cool. And they have cameras. The last one had 17 cameras, and this one's got 23 cameras. So, more to Maria. They're going to have better navigation system for when it comes down and lands. They could do more of a pinpoint landing. So they chose a real good science location, but they need to have it a little bit more accurate than where this one went. Curiosity went to Gale Crater, which was, large, maybe 20 miles in diameter. They had to hit. This one's, half that or less than half that distance that it has to hit. And it's going to go into a place called Jezero Crater. So That's where they expect to find a lot of good science. The scientists and the engineers argue back and forth. Engineers want to, you know, they're happy going to a nice, safe, flat place, and engineers want to go to all these rough places because that's where, the scientists want to go to all the rough places because that's where the science is. So they compromise. They're going to go to Jezero Crater, located about 3,000 miles away, so... Curiosity landed in New York, 2020 would be landing in California. So that's the story on that. The arm is much heavier, weighs about 100 pounds instead of 60 pounds, and that's because of all the drills and everything that the Mars 2020 rover has, core boring drills. Mass cam is supposed to be more improved, the vision on it. And what I really like about 2020, and Dick, you're going to like this too, is, I've heard you talk about me too, it's going to have two microphones on board. So that's going to be great. You'll be able to hear the wind going through past the real sound of the wind going through past the microphones and the machinery, the wheels, moving, going up and down the rough of the terrain, and that should be really cool. I'm very happy to bring in microphones. Not only one microphone, but two microphones. I haven't found the location of both of them. I know one's on the body of the rover, and I think the other one might be on the... on the aero, maybe connected to the aero shell or something. So if that's true, that means we're going to lose one microphone after it lands. I thought, we'll probably have time to figure that out before July. But I know they wanted to listen to it as it went through the atmosphere. So it could probably be on it. Maybe it's on the body. Also, this one has a helicopter on board. The other one didn't have a helicopter. There were these big, three and a half foot long blades, and that's on the bottom of the helicopter, on the bottom of the rover. After it lands, it's going to disconnect, it's going to leave it there, and then the rover drives away, and the helicopter will be able to take off, and, in the beginning, like a minute at a time, it increases. As the flights progress, they hope to get at least four flights out of it before they have trouble. Helicopter is solar powered. It doesn't have a nuke on it, so it'll land and recharge during the day. Let me drop it. Any questions or comments so far dealing with these rovers? Well, 2020 rover, I'll be glad when they have a name of it, by the way. It has an oxygen generating system on it, and they call it MOXIE. MOXIE is the name of it. So, that's another acronym. Essentially, it's going to take the oxygen out of the air, and it's going to... separated from the carbon dioxide on Mars from the atmosphere, and it's going to create essentially maybe a quart of a couple of pints of the equivalent of oxygen. We're going to see how that works out, because if that works out fine, and they think it will, in the future they'll be able to send up other rocket launches. In fact, you might need a whole rocket launch dedicated to one massive MOXIE thing to produce tremendous amount of oxygen on Mars, because they need it for future astronauts to not only breathe, but they want to liquefy it and use it for oxidation for fuel on Mars for launching a vehicle back to Earth. We'll see if MOXIE works. Hopefully that works. And By the way, it's too late to sign up to get a passport to go on this thing. My name is engraved along with millions of other people on some kind of a chip that they put on the body of 2020. So not bad. At least you don't have to pay for it. It was free. And they, you know, they send you an email back, and you wind up with this passport. You can send it through your printer. I did that. I'm signed up to go to Mars. Let's see. Mars Aero Shells. I'll talk about that. Let me drop it. It's now ready. Being shipped, finally put together. Aeroshell consists of two parts. You know, the top aeroshell part, which attaches to the cruise stage for the whole trip from Mars, from Earth to Mars. You know, before that, of course, it needs a launch, and it's going to launch on an Atlas V rocket, and it's going to have four solid boosters attached to the vehicle. And, it's going to have this it's around 15-foot diameter fairing. It's going to be encapsulating the whole Mars rover system. And then once Atlas V goes up, it's going to have sent to a rocket. That's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket, which will push it to Mars. And that will separate. And then from there you have just the cruise stage. And then you have this aeroshell. Now the aeroshell is finally finished. Cruise stage was done a long time ago. So you have the top part, sure. And then you have the bottom part, which is the heat shield. Heat shield has to, you know, withstand like 3,000 degrees as it goes through the Mars atmosphere. Even though the Mars atmosphere is very thin, it hits that atmosphere, it's going to heat up. And it doesn't hit the atmosphere as fast as it hits here. When you deorbit from the space station, you're going 17,500 miles an hour. It has to slow down from before it hits the atmosphere. This thing has to slow down from around a little over 13,000 miles an hour. And then it drops through the atmosphere. Eventually, you have drogue chutes that come out. Big supersonic parachute that comes out that has to work at like 1,300 miles an hour. And it's a massive thing. And then it'll slow down even more. And when you get a couple miles above the surface, the parachutes pull the top part of the aeroshell away. You're going to have the vehicle drop. It's going to be in. It's got the sky crane set up. It's the exact same set up as Curiosity. So what's interesting, you can actually bring up Curiosity YouTube on how they land it, and you can see how they do it. You know, the heat shield parachute, aeroshell, and the heat shield will drop off the bottom, and that exposes the... Timed out. Anyway, the rover drops away from the aeroshell. Has these cables on it. Drops around 50 feet. And then that aeroshell completely disappears, and you're left with the sky crane with the rover dangling below it. And the sky crane has these eight rockets, these jets that come on, and they start pulsing. And it brings it closer and closer to the ground. Until the rover wheels, you know, they open up, they're all folded up before they launch. So they all automatically open up, six wheels are sticking out. And then as they hit the ground, the pyrotechnics go off, these little explosions go, and they have these little, call them razor blades, these blades cut these cables, and You know, it's almost like a guillotine setup. Well, you know, that explosion does that. It forces the these blades to cut everything, and then you know, the data cables and everything, and then this aeroshell takes off and flies away from the vehicle, leaving the rover on the ground. And if the fall goes well, like happened back in August of 2012, we'll have now two more rovers riding around on Mars, similar to what we had with Opportunity and Spirit. When they landed at different parts of the planet. They landed 2 weeks apart. One was January 4th, you know, only 2 weeks later. You know, Spirit and Opportunity, where they were about the size of a golf cart, you know. Nowhere near as big as Curiosity or Mars 2020. But they were very successful. They had solar panels. They didn't have any nukes on board. They had nuclear fuel in some sense to keep the keep all the batteries and everything, all the circuitry warm. And they had it in a box called the WEB, W-E-B, warm electronic box. And it was so successful that, you know, it was only just last year that the last rover, Opportunity, finally quit because of a planetary storm. Gigantic dust storm. Light couldn't get to the rover, and eventually the batteries failed to the point where they weren't able to recharge when the sun finally did come out, like months and months later. So that left us with, just Curiosity. Now, also next year, the same month, European Space Agency has been working on a rover called the Rosalind Franklin. And that rover is, you know, again, it's a little bit bigger than Opportunity, but not as big as Curiosity. And that one is solar panel. So they're working on a rover as well. They're going to try for the first time to successfully land anything on Mars. They tried a couple of times. They tried Beagle 2. That didn't work. They tried Schiaparelli a couple of years ago. That didn't work. But, it did leave one of their orbiters in orbit. Successfully in orbit. But the lander did not work out. It wouldn't have lasted long anyway. It was the first time they were going to try something like that. It was battery operated. It would have lasted around 48 hours. But that wound up crashing into the surface. So good luck to the European Space Agency with their rover. They're going to launch it on a Russian rocket, a Proton rocket. And right around the same time, I think a little after July 17th, when Mars 2020 rover is launched, they're going to launch their rover. And not to be outdone, China plans on doing the same thing. I don't know if they're ready, though. They have problems with one of their rockets. They've been trying to develop a heavy lift rocket. And if that doesn't successfully work next month, they're going to be in trouble. If it does, then they have a shot of putting their rover on Mars as well. Anyway, anybody have any comments or questions for the space portion of the tank? We started talking earlier in the net. Dick brought up New Shepard number 12 that was launched by Blue Origin, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, and richest guy in the world. And he's been at this for quite a few years. He had the first few years back in 2004, he kept trying to keep it a real secret, but eventually the word got out that he's in West Texas building rockets and he's got a launch complex. New Shepard is not going to be an orbital vehicle. It's going to be suborbital. discussed this many, many times. I think two flights ago, used a mannequin. They put a mannequin inside the, you know, with all kinds of indicators on it. Got a lot of information back on it. But the goal of New Shepard is to launch tourists into suborbital space. So in other words, they get above the common line. Common line is 100 kilometers, so 62 miles up. Unless you're involved with the Air Force, it's 50 miles and above space. So there's always an argument about that. But on an international basis, it's considered 62 miles up. And that's how high this thing goes, just above that. So, you know, without any doubt, you'll become an astronaut if you could pay the $250,000 to sit on this thing with five other people. And as of a couple of years ago, I don't know if they've changed it. It's, you know, it's just you and five other people that are going to be taking a ride into suborbital space. No pilot, no co-pilot. You know, you get in and, you know, after training a little bit, you get in, you lock down into your seat. They have massive windows. I mean, these are not little portholes. These are massive windows that you can look out of. You sit on top of this. It's only got one booster. It only has one rocket to get you up to suborbital flight. And it's called a BE-3 rocket. And it's similar to the same kind of fuel that the space shuttle had. It's liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And it's successful. I mean, they've launched this vehicle and up into suborbital space and brought it back without people in it and 12 times now. And landed it. It comes down vertically. They have a concrete pad out in the middle of West Texas. And it comes down with three big blue parachutes and lands right in the desert. I think they have little rockets that fire off at the last second, similar to what the Russians have when it lands, to try to soften the blow when it hit. But this is all for about 5 or 6 minutes of zero-G gravity. You know, you get into the rocket, take off, takes you about, I don't know, 5 minutes to get up to the common line. You know, first stage separates, or the only stage separates, and you're just in a crew vehicle. First stage goes, you know, falls all the way back to Earth, lands vertically. You're in a vehicle with five other people, and you get on most of your seatbelts, you know, float around for 5 minutes. Hopefully, before the gravity starts, you find your way back to your seat with no other help. I mean, there's not going to be somebody to help you. Get back to your seat, tie yourself in, because now you're going to come down and you're going to start to feel some G's on the way back. And then parachutes open, and you hopefully successfully land in the it's almost like a desert out in West Texas. And with that, he would qualify for astronaut wing. So, he's been working on this for years. He thought he would be able to start sending people up toward the end of this year. But, you know, there were no problems that I saw, but I guess there's development problems. They're trying to perfect everything. And, the next vehicle that they're bringing out of the factory is going to be the next New Shepard. Will be the one that will be used for crew vehicles. So that, you know, they're going to start off with a pilot, co-pilot, take it from there. Eventually, if they feel it's safe after multiple flights, I guess they'll start collecting money to take a ride to suborbital space. So that's the story on New Shepard. Got up to around 2,200 miles an hour. And every one of them, it's amazing to watch to see this thing come down. I mean, it looks like it's going to come down and just hit the ground and burst apart. But right before it gets to the hit the ground, the rocket fires again, the same D3 engine, and the thing just slows down, and it's got a gimbaling mechanism, so that rocket is moving around on the bottom, all kinds of different angles, and it just lands perfectly, you know, like 1 mile an hour. Any comments or questions? I guess not. NASA came out with a water map, by the way, a map of where water is now located. And they're sure that they know where all the different locations could be on Mars. And in fact, they actually found liquid water. I thought they were going to say, when I read this, that, oh, they found a puddle somewhere. But what they did is they're looking below the ice in the northern hemisphere of Mars. And they have the capability of looking a mile below the surface, and they can figure out from their system that they're using that there's liquid water down there below the ice. So that is confirmed. And they use the Mars Express. Mars Express is the spacecraft that was sent up by European Space Agency years ago. That's still in orbit around the planet. It's got the big antennas, these like dipole antennas that came out. I think it's working on 80 meters. So maybe it's about. I'm sure it's not in the ham band, but I think it's near it, and it's sending a wave down through the ice, and it's bouncing back up. And every time they go over the pole, it's in polar orbit. So every time they go over the pole, they look at this. And from a collection of data, they figured out that there is the actual liquid water sloshing around under the ice of polar ice, you know, similar to what you have on Antarctica. Go down deep enough, you have liquid water on the Antarctica as well. So, any questions? Okay. The Omega rocket is coming along. They're starting to sign up contracts. Omega is a rocket, a solid booster rocket, holding a solid booster. So you get to the final stage, and then it becomes liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. But the main booster is essentially what, you know, it's an improved version of one of the solid boosters that you would have had for the space shuttle. And it's being developed all these years now by Orbital ATK, which has since been bought up now by Northrop Grumman. And it's a heavy launch vehicle. And they're going to be launching from either the Cape or from, Cape Kennedy or from Vandenberg Air Force Base with this vehicle. And they expect to launch in 2021. So just another competitor built by Northrop Grumman. And they plan on using the Launch Complex 39B. See, what happens is that, you know, Launch Complex 39A, everybody realizes, well, you know, you follow a space program, that's where, you know, the Apollo 11 was launched from, and that's where over half the amount of shuttles will launch from, the other half of shuttles will launch from Launch Complex 39B. We had two identical launch complexes, 39A, 39B. 39A has been since rented out or turned over to SpaceX, and SpaceX launches its Falcon 9 rockets now. Redeveloped that launch complex so much that they put the swing arm, this crew swing arm, attached to the new launch complex that they had built. So they launched the rockets from 39A now, but eventually they'll be launching the crew you know, from 39A as well, when they first do that. They actually launched a vehicle from there with a crew vehicle on it. It was uncrewed back in March, 39A. And long story short, this 39B, what happens with 39B? Well, NASA has been redeveloping that launch complex as well, building an even bigger launch complex facility over there for their SLS rocket, Space Launch System. And their Orion spacecraft, which will be on top of that, which will eventually carry, again, a crew of four, but not the International Space Station, to the moon. That's what the SLS is all about. And eventually to Mars. Well, Space Launch System is only going to launch like once a year. You know, they'll launch one to the moon, another one to the moon, and, you know, eventually they get around to launching to Mars. That all launch takes place in Launch Complex 39C. You know, these are, you know, like 40-story buildings, as far as I'm concerned. They're massive structures. Well, there's going to be a good portion of the year that it's not going to be in use, 39B. So, Northrop Grumman will be launching the Omegas rocket, the solid booster rocket. It's a solid, you know, a solid fueled rocket from 39B. It'll be a shared vehicle, so they'll be able to launch a couple of times a year. They have long-term goals. Their short-term goals is to launch a lot of military satellites. They stand to get a lot of military contracts. But in the future, they will have the capability of launching the Orion spacecraft, I mean, if they wanted to. That's in the back of their minds. I mean, it was built initially, they called it the Liberty, the Liberty program, and at one point it was the Ares 1 project. Both were planned on eventually carrying crew spacecraft on top. So, Northrop Grumman actually has a plan. It was going to be years from that because they first have to start launching this in 2021. And once they launch probably dozens of rockets, they'll get around to developing the vehicle to launch a crew vehicle. But it has been their long-term plan. So you're going to have a lot of vehicles that, you know, if we're around long enough, we're going to be seeing all kinds of launches of people from the United States, and of course, you know, the other countries will be into it as well. You know, Russia will still be doing it. China has done it in the past, and they'll continue on. And even India is getting into the manned space program. They have a plan on, you know, not too distant future to actually launch a crew of three to nowhere. They have no space station to go to, but in the beginning, they plan on orbiting the Earth just to see if they can do it. So, exciting times if we stick around. Let me turn it over to Dick, unless somebody has a question. I've pretty much run out of material. Dick, K2RIW, this is WS2R. While we're waiting for Dick, does anybody have any comments, questions, good news, bad news, anything? Did I put anybody to sleep, or did I wake anybody up? Any questions, comments? If not, we'll stand by, see if Dick's out there. K2RIW, WS2R. Roy, are you still with us? I know you are. AC2GS, this is WS2N.
Yes, Paul. For failure, I'll always stick with you.
Barrigan, just waiting for Dick to come back. I didn't have any other material. Gonna turn it over to you. Hopefully I can see if I can get to Ham Radio University. That sounds good. January 4th. I went to the very first one. It was like 19 years ago. Of course, it wasn't a different place. It wasn't in CW Post. But I like the CW Post better. Back to you, Roy.
It's an interesting place. I wasn't quite sure what it was at first, and then I realized it was your basic student center. I had spent significant amounts of my time at NYU as a student center, but it's a kind of universal architecture. It's a place to have these. Most of the, I think all of the talks are basically encapsulated in 1 hour, but somehow we're kind of breaking the mold, and they've given us 2 hours to play with. So that should be loads of fun.
Okay, yeah, that sounds good. 2 hours is better than one. And very good. You're getting a little noisy. I wonder, am I noisy? Yeah, I should have recorded myself. Am I noisy?
Particularly, the repeater is not having a good night. Fortunately, I stream the audio to people. They sort of complain because what was happening was usually I get about a minus 15 dBm. Now, tonight it's minus 83 dBm. And it's just low enough that when I start transmitting with one radio, I detect the front end and it's more noise. So I've kind of pulled back my power so that I'm not desensing my front end that much.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, okay, you dropped down power a little bit. Okay, yeah, you are a little lower than before. I mean, I copy everything, but I do notice the difference. I mean, I'm going into Selman, so... Yeah, I knew early on I was going to have a problem going into Glen Oaks. That's interesting. Glen Oaks. I was going to kick out of that. I grew up walking distance from Glen Oaks. So, in fact, those buildings, when they went up, I remember watching them go up as I was a kid from my house. Little I know, the antennas were going to be up there. Okay, let's see if Dick's back. K2RIW, WS2N. Okay, I had no other traffic, no other topics, but I'm sure I'll have a long list next week. You know, sometimes you go through Monday and you don't see anything on Tuesday. Next thing you know, day after day, you got one new thing that comes out after another, and that's what happens. Well, tomorrow night at 7, whatever time it was, I forgot what it was, 7:20 or something. If you bring up the SpaceX webcast, webcast, they always have all the flights, whether it's NASA or not. This is not NASA, so you would not get the launch on NASA TV, but you would get it on the SpaceX launch site. But that's always pretty good, and that'll be from Cape Canaveral. Always good to watch those launches. It's 7:10 tomorrow night. So I'll have to set a reminder. And it's really cool to watch this thing. You know, they go up, and I just like watching the booster come down and land on the drone ship. Now they're going to have another drone ship. They used to have another one out in California, but there's not too many launches going on there for the next foreseeable future. They are going to have a lot of launches from Florida, so they bought the drone ship from California, actually through the Panama Canal, and it's so big, you know, this drone ship is, they have these big wings, let's call them wings, they fold out to the side, it's as big, bigger than, like a football field, you know, like 300 foot by 300 foot, but you know, they fold these wings in and it's more narrow. They can fit through the Panama Canal. But when they got to the other side, they bought it for, you know, for upgrade. They call them thrusters, these big electric powered motored thrusters, you know, there's four of them in each corner, and they're able to maneuver. They can stay very still in the ocean. And they've realized that lately they've been doing these higher inclination flights. In other words, instead of going like 28 degrees, you know, or even to the 0 degree location for geosynchronous, they want to go 53 degrees north, 53 degrees inclination. And the reason for that is that Starlink, these 500-pound satellites, there's like 60 in each launch, and they've already done two of them. And they want to do countless more next year, I think 24 flights next year. So there's going to be a lot of flights from Florida at a high inclination. To do that, they have to go out where the currents, you know, the Atlantic current, you know, flows from the south to the north. They're sitting in this Gulf Stream, and they're having a hard time staying there. They noticed that recently. So they had to upgrade these thrusters. So they put these massive thrusters in, you know, I thought they were big before. I saw a picture of they bolted it to the ship, and they bought it over, and then they put four more on top of the deck because they're going to give that to the other drone ship that's in the Cape Canaveral now, and they're going to do both of them. This way they can have like one flight after the other, you know, as one drone ship is coming back, another one could be going out to sea. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N.
Sorry that called away. thank you, Paul. Roy, any final comments?
It's always. Yes, if anyone has any questions of an explanation that they would like to ask Dick, and they don't have access to a radio or echo link, they can utilize the mailbag. Or if there's something you want to get in touch with Paul about, either tell him about a website you read or a topic you'd like to discuss or questions you'd like answered, or if you would like to ask me any questions or comments or suggest topics or puzzles. The email address that works is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And links for everything that I talked about are already available. You can watch them to your heart's content. You can get to the page by typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. So I hope you look at them. I hope you enjoy the videos. They're very entertaining and informative. And thanks, as always, to Dick and Paul and everyone who participated tonight, who made it what it was. And we'll be back again next week to try and do it all over again. And remember, Ham Radio University, January 4th. And me and Andy will be putting on our little show, but there's a lot of other shows and topics so all day long. So think about it. And if you do drop by, pass by. I am, and say hello. So this is AC2GS, Roy here, and until next week, guys, take it easy. This is AC2GS.
Very fine, Roy. Roy, I think you'd like to know that your last transmission, all of it, was about 40% noise, 6% audio, so for some reason the signal got quite a bit weaker in the repeater. Bye-bye, you all. See you next week. Please be kind to each other. K2RIW clear.
73 Dick and 73 Roy. And Roy said he cut back his power a little bit before. So have a good night. We'll be back next week. And let's see, tomorrow's the club info net, 8:30 on 3 Peters. good night. Go Walmart. Go TechNet.
That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5:00 a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
WB2VSE, are you listening today? WHCDL.
W2.
For the next few minutes, WB2ZSE.
Oh, listen to this. I'm hearing something on the repeaters, and it sounds like a bad connection to the antenna. And I'm watching it on my service monitor. The signal will drop about 2 or 3 dB suddenly, with a burst of, like a clicking sound, something clicking. And it's happening right now, as I talk. Right now it's coming in at minus 71, and when I hear the click, it drops down immediately to 74. And I notice it, not rhythmically, but randomly. So, it appears that it could be a connection. It just happened again, by the way. Now it's down to 74 as I talk, and it's giving a distinctive click, like RF being touching something or opening or what have you. This could be a connection somewhere. Just thought I'd mention it.
Nope. Understand. Didn't hear it click, but I did hear a slight difference RF-wise, which I can't believe I heard, but because it's so minor.
You got to listen.